When I was 8 years old, my parents gave me a book, A Children's Introduction to the Solar System. I read the book cover to cover. I was so inspired by what I learned, I sat down and wrote an essay about it. Not a summary of the book, but a statement of faith about what I had gathered from the book. Now, I remember doing this because at the time I was also learning how to use a typewriter. So I typed the essay, the statement of faith, and many years later I had it framed. It hangs in my bathroom, which is the proper place to hang the essays of eight-year-olds, I think. So here for your listening pleasure is an excerpt from the essay entitled The Earth, Moon, and Sun. The Earth is big, but not as big as the sun. The moon is big, but not as big as the sun. The sun is very bright. The sun is very, very hot. The moon is high in the sky, but not the earth. Oh no, not the earth. We live on the earth. The earth was made by God. Leave it to me to bring God into the conversation. The earth was made by God. The moon was made by God. The sun was made by God. When the earth was born, it was red. Now that statement there, that is what set my family apart from everyone else in town who were Baptists. Our Earth is only a speck in the universe. Your town is only a very little speck on the Earth. But if your town was as big as the sun, we would not live because it would smash us. If God put many towns together, he still would not get something as big as the sun, unless they were big, big towns. The sun is made of fire. The sun is very, very, very bright. If you got close to the sun, you would be burnt to a crisp. We have not made a rocket that could go all the way to the moon. Now, at this point, I got curious about something. I got up from the typewriter, I walked into the kitchen, and asked my mother, who was always in the kitchen, this was 1965, I asked my mother, Mom, when I grow up, can I go in a rocket to the moon? And my mother, without hesitation, responded, no, you would have to be a man if you wanted to go in a rocket to the moon. I took in the full impact of that, walked back to the typewriter, and wrote the following. You would have to be a man if you wanted to go in a rocket to the moon. If you went up, 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 up high in the sky and tried to get to the very, very top, you still would not get to the top. Because the sky will never end. The end. That, my friends, was my debut publication as an aspiring religious cosmologist. Nothing remarkable in writing style, or mastery of information. Nor in punctuation or typing accuracy, I can assure you. But among statements of faith, this one was remarkable for the sources upon which I relied. How did I know that what I wrote was true? In part, I relied on my own powers of observation. The sun is very bright, right? The moon is high in the sky. And I relied upon what I had learned from the book. Our Earth is only a speck in the universe. When the Earth was born, it was red. I relied upon what I had learned in church. The Earth, moon, and sun were made by God. And finally, I relied upon the deep, unimpeachable wisdom of my mother. Four sources of authority: eyes, book, church, mother. Every statement of faith has its sources, and those were mine. This morning, in our lesson from Matthew's Gospel, we encounter another statement of faith, an iconic statement of faith. Jesus walked on water. So iconic, it has been used for 2,000 years as a litmus test of orthodoxy. Do you believe that Jesus walked on water? Every Christian has their own answer to that question. And the answer reveals something about what they rely on as their sources of authority for answering the really big questions. Let me illustrate. Many of us were churched as children, right? We grew up in a congregation where the priest or pastor had authority. There was a consensus of faith, a set of beliefs that had authority. There was a holy book appealed to as an authority. There was a deity, one with whom we were encouraged to have a personal relationship, who was an authority. As children, we did not question any of that authority. We just understood it was the way things were. The community was harmonious. Faith was a plan of living. Everyone agreed on the plan. Life was decent and orderly. Did Jesus walk on water? Yes, we would say he did, because the Bible tells me so. And some people stayed there contentedly the rest of their lives, never once doubting that truth. But what happens to children given enough time, food, and water? They grow up, but first, they grow into teenagers. And in adolescence, there is one major developmental task called adolescent rebellion, or more specifically, a couple of big words here, deconstruction and individuation. As adolescents, we begin to be exposed to ideas and experiences beyond our tribe, beyond our kin. We take classes in physics, astronomy, psychology. We learn about human genetics and carbon dating. We read the literature of dissent and liberation, experience the religions of other cultures. We listen to music with lyrics that would not be at home in church. We learn to do critical reflection. We individuate. We detach ourselves from our tribe and begin to rely on ourselves as a source of authority for answering the big questions. Gradually, we refocus our gaze. What formerly seemed sacred and unbreachable is now held up for scrutiny and interrogation. Parents become ridiculous. Church becomes irrelevant. Holy texts are found to be full of holes. The edifice of belief is deconstructed brick by brick. Adolescent rebellion is what happens when the truths that we have received as children clash with our newly revered sources of authority, higher learning, self-reliance, critical thinking. This is why the most we see of our young adults in church is their backsides as they walk out the door. And we would be foolhardy to try and hold them back. Because that rebellion, that deconstruction and individuation, those are a necessary part of our lifelong quest for meaning. Did Jesus walk on water? No, our young adult would say, because that defies the laws of nature. And some people stay there contentedly the rest of their lives without once doubting that truth. But some of us, after enough years of subsisting on the dry bread of rationalism, enough years of making neat distinctions between what is truth and what is myth, enough years of living in an orderly, three-dimensional world, some of us begin to crave something deeper, something a little messier. This rarely happens in young adulthood because we have so many dragons to slay, so many contests to win. But around midlife, we begin to recognize that truth has an aggravating way of following its own elusive rules. We learn that truth is more dimensional, more porous than we previously thought. We don't give up the critical tools that served us so well over the years, but we no longer trust them alone as our authority in answering the big questions. We take another look at the stories and symbols and myths of our childhood, fetch them from the back of the closet where we discarded them so many years earlier, and we begin to play with them a little. Let them play with us. We rework them, reposition their parts. Slowly, over time, those stories and symbols and myths begin to breathe again. They take on a new shine. We are older now, more mature. We know the symbols are not what we once thought they were. A symbol is not itself divine. It merely stands in for what is divine, points to what is deeper. The symbols are not what we once thought they were, but we embrace them anew because we need them now in our lives. Why? We need the dying and rising God to help us find our way back from the thousand little deaths we endure throughout our lives. We need that magic elixir of body and blood to grant us a taste of sweet divinity, to temper the bitterness of our humanity. We need the God-man who could walk on water because our souls hunger for the playfulness of improbability and paradox. What we once rejected because it contradicted reason, we now take up and dance with precisely because it contradicts reason. At last, we understand paradox and contradiction and improbability, those are the only worthy authority. Those are precisely where truth really lives. Now, if someone were to ask us, did Jesus walk on water? We would tell them they are asking the wrong question. The question they should ask is, what was it about Jesus that was so transformative for the people around him that they could believe he could walk on water? What was it about Jesus that could lure Peter, Andrew, James, and John away from their nets and their fishing boats? Could heal the tortured mind of Mary Magdalene and make her a disciple? Could lay bare the wasted inner life of the woman at the Samaritan well and send her forth as an evangelist? Whatever that was, it was irresistible. It was transcendence itself, unveiled before them. There was nothing for it but to take their tidy little ideas of what was fact and what was myth, their carefully curated statements of faith, their notions of where they ended and eternity began, and set it all aside. Did Jesus walk on water? One thing is for sure. Jesus changed the whole game. He cracked the game wide open. He reached into the habitations of their souls and rearranged the very furniture. If he could do that for them, if he could do that for us. He could walk on water. And those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Amen.